The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We're off and running on another week of broadcasting. Actually, we had Dwight Falk sitting in on yesterday's program. I was able to wake up from a nice, peaceful sleep to Mr. Falk yesterday morning. Very nice. No rush to hurry out of bed for once. But it's good to be back with you. So much to talk about. We're going to actually follow up a little bit on some of what we talked about Friday with the World War II anniversary over the weekend, and then some more commentary that's come through regarding Jim Comey and the IG's report that came out on Thursday. So we'll talk more about that in the Jim Comey report later on in this segment, and then some of that history and prophecy to go with it in the second segment. First, I'll just update you quickly. I believe Mr. Falk updated you on some of this yesterday, but the storm update Sunday, it looked like it was at its greatest intensity, but out over the Atlantic, I think, though, the Bahamas have taken the biggest hit as it just kind of hovered over the Bahamas yesterday. But on Sunday, it got up to as high as, I think, 185 miles per hour, with wind gusts up to 220. So it seems like it is weakening. And for the United States, the news is fairly positive, I guess, as it looks like at this point it's down to a Category 3 to move to a weaker storm here in the next few days as it kind of rolls up the coast there with Florida and Georgia and the Carolinas. I think there have been some evacuations along those coastal cities. As I say, it looks like our brethren down in the Bahamas have been hit the hardest. So I don't have any reports from them, but but the nation, certainly I think there's five deaths to this point, has been hit pretty hard. So we'll keep our eyes on that, and hopefully we can have some later updates as the week progresses. Well, as was also discussed on yesterday's show, we had another mass shooting in Texas. Texas is just being hit hard by one shooting after another. This gunman that opened fire out on a highway, killing seven people, or he may have been one of the casualties in that that exchange. But this from the Associated Press. It says an FBI agent says the gunman in a West Texas rampage that killed seven people was on a long spiral down before he was fired from his job on the day of the shooting. So like is usual, there were lots of warning signs along the way. I think he threatened one of his neighbors recently as well with a gun, and the police didn't do anything about that. So there's always, again, the politics of this is so predictable. But when you look at the many disturbing signs, and even just the, we'll talk a little bit in a moment here about law enforcement and just how they've got their hands full, to be sure. But when you just think about the mental derangement and how many people are just disturbed mentally, leave aside the argument over how many guns are in the United States, and there are a lot of them, there's no denying that. And it does make for a toxic mix. If you've got a lot of guns and a lot of crazy people. But why are there so many people disturbed mentally? Why are there so many people just off the rails? And it's getting worse. And we have all these drugs that's supposed to slow this kind of thing down. It's not helping. It's not helping. Here he evidently called the authorities before the rampage. And so there were signs along the way. We've got an article, by the way, in the latest Trumpet, The Real Solution to Mass Shootings and Violence. And in that article, my father does focus on law enforcement. He says here, in many places in America, our law enforcement is simply too overtaxed to adequately address crimes that occur. In some cities, the majority of murders are going unpunished. That means the killers are winning. This is a story you rarely even hear about. Because, well, maybe it's not 10 or 15 that are murdered at once, but there's just murders going on all the time. And in many cases, the murderers are getting off scot-free. It says, within our present governmental system, we cannot solve the terrifying problem of violence. We're having trouble even deterring it. And then he goes on to talk about the good news. There is a system of government coming. God's government. The kingdom of God is soon to be established on this earth. And then finally, we're going to see real solutions to mass shootings and violence. Well, it's been quite the weekend as well for Britain. And Brexit, Boris Johnson suspending Parliament, and of course his opponents just absolutely beside themselves, trying to do anything that they can to stop the inevitable, trying to do anything that they can, really, as you'll hear from Jacob Rees-Mogg in just a moment, to stay in the European Union. That's really what they want. Yesterday it was announced that Jeremy Corbyn, he's the minority leader, that he's going to put legislation to Parliament today that seeks to prevent a no-deal Brexit and extend the Brexit deadline by 3 months. Another extension. When was the vote? June of 2016, I think it was. And here we are in September of 2019, and they're seeking another extension. This is a tweet from Boris Johnson today. He said, Jeremy Corbyn wants to cancel the referendum and argue about Brexit for years. I am committed to leading our country forward and getting Britain out of the EU by October 31st. Whether there's a deal or not, he says. This is the deadline, and we're sticking to it. Now, what's interesting, Brad McDonald was telling me this morning, there's quite a few conservative MPs that have said they'll support Corbyn's legislation. They've said they're going to vote for it. And Boris Johnson said yesterday that if the government is defeated in the vote today, I assume it's today, maybe tomorrow, we'll see, then that he's prepared to take the country to national elections on October 14th, he's determined to even get rid of the conservative MPs who want to side with Corbyn. So things are certainly heating up in Britain politically right around the time of the Feast of Tabernacles. Here's that clip from Jacob Rees-Mogg. He's talking about the fact that they've had, well, the laws are in place. We know what to do because of the law. And all of these other people are just trying to skirt around the issues. They're trying to skirt around law. This was him on Jacob Rees-Mogg. He's a conservative in the UK on Good Morning Britain just today, clip 5.
And the people who are opposed to no deal may jump up and down a lot. And actually what they really mean is they don't want to leave the European Union. And it's important to remember that the no deal talk is code, is cover for the fact that they want to overturn what 17.4 million people voted for. But the law says that we leave, and we've had three laws in relation to this. We had the Referendum Act, we had the Article 50 Act, and the Withdrawal Act. And the law cannot be overturned by a mere motion in Parliament. The law is of a higher and more important standing, and that has been passed by Parliament in a proper democratic way.
The law is of a higher and more important standing. That's Jacob Rees-Mogg upholding the law of the land. There have been three laws passed in a proper democratic way, as he says there. And the opponents of the prime minister, they want to try to get around it. with a motion of some kind or a delay. And it seems like the prime minister is determined to go forward with what the law says to do. That's in the UK. I got this this alert from GermanForeignPolicy.com just before coming up here this morning. But listen to this. The title is Fighting for Germany. Recently, a party represented in the German parliament published its program for the military. The program is not secret. The voters going to the polls in two German states on September 1st could know this program. It says up to 28% of the voters have chosen the party with this program. It wants to further militarize Germany. So that's pulling in 28% of the vote in these two states. It says the 28% party is calling for a radical restoration of the German Bundeswehr. The military draft should be reinstated, it says, and the number of troops to be raised to 23,000 soldiers as a first step. An additional 50,000 men reserves would be necessary. The German military, it literally states, would be authorized to intervene domestically. I'm not sure exactly what that means, to intervene domestically. The foreign duties of the Bundeswehr should be exercised in every corner of the earth. So here's a German party that's calling for the militarization of Germany. And this is not, as we've been pointing out with so many of these elections in Germany in recent years, this is not some fringe, you know, 1% or 2% group. These are groups that are gaining in popularity. Last week, I wasn't able to get to this story about the dominance of the U.S. dollar. It's from Money Week. It says, when central bankers attend their annual get-together at Jackson Hole in Wyoming this week, all eyes were on Jerome Powell. I think this was actually a couple of weeks ago. He's the chair of the Federal Reserve, America's central bank. But in the end, it was the Bank of England governor, Mark Carney, who came out with the most interesting speech. It says, people who talk about the demise of the dollar have been viewed as cranks for decades now. Yet in his own technocratic way, that's exactly what Carney was forecasting. Here's the Bank of England governor, Mark Carney. It says the end of the current global monetary regime. That's what he's predicting. And then this article goes on and says about a third of countries peg their currencies to the U.S. dollar. It accounts for about two-thirds of global currency reserves. It's the currency used in at least half of international trade invoices, even between countries who don't use the dollar. In short, it's the global reserve currency. It says the dollar's share of global transactions of all sorts is far, far bigger than America's share of global GDP. See, at one time, it was the British pound that was the dominant currency in the world. The world's global reserve currency. And what this Mark Carney is predicting is that the days of the dollar dominance, they're numbered. And it used to be, like Money Week brings out here, to talk about this, you'd be viewed as a crank. But not anymore. This was at this annual gathering in Wyoming of all of these central bankers. Well, there's a temporary resurgence going on, as we know. But the days are numbered. Quite a few commentaries on the IG report that came out last Thursday. We talked about it on Friday's program. You can go back and listen to those podcasts. They're at the Trumpet.com website. But this from American Greatness. It says Attorney General Bill Barr has appointed John Durham. This is talking basically about how that report from Friday, 79 pages, that's just the first step. There's two or three other investigations going on, including the one headed up by John Durham, to investigate the origins of the Trump-Russia probe. How did this all get started in the first place? This article says, when Durham looks for who planted the stupid idea that Trump colluded with Russia, he will find in each instance that it was the DNC, that's the Democratic National Committee, the DNC working with the Clinton campaign, and Comey was involved up to his neck. And we saw that from the report last week. And the significance of that 40-day transition period, early December through to the inauguration on January 20th, 2017, and the plotting going on, that meeting with Barack Obama and all of his intel chiefs, January 5th, 2017, and then the next day, Comey went in there to talk to President Trump. He had to tell him about the salacious details in the Steele dossier. And really, it was all a setup, and we learned that from the report last week. I'll read from Andrew McCarthy here in just a moment. But this article here, speaking of the DNC and the Clinton campaign, it says in a January 11th, 2017. So here's another significant date right in that 40-day period. In a January 11, 2017 story headlined Ukrainian efforts to sabotage Trump backfire. Politico reported that Alexandra Chalupa, a Ukrainian-American operative, began doing opposition research for the DNC about Donald Trump and Russia in late 2015. It says the Ukrainian embassy worked closely with Chalupa to undermine Trump's campaign. As Politico noted, the Ukrainian efforts had an impact in the race, helping to force Manafort's resignation and advancing the narrative that Trump's campaign was deeply connected to Ukraine's foe to the east, Russia. It says Chalupa was so successful in fanning the Russia nonsense that on October 24th, 2016, reporter Michael Isikoff at Yahoo News portrayed her work as pivotal in a premature victory lap for the Clinton campaign. They thought they were going to win, and she was doing good work, exposing all of these ties between Russia and Trump. And of course, no Americans, they're not going to vote for Donald Trump. He was having, Vladimir Putin was pulling his strings, so nobody could trust then-candidate Trump. It says a single uncredentialed agitator was not enough for Hillary and her crew. The Clinton campaign and the DNC commissioned the Steele dossier to give British spy-level credibility to Chalupa's Chicken Little Act, he calls it. It was all a farce, a big hoax. It started with this woman's research. Ukrainian efforts to sabotage Donald Trump. And then they wanted to lend it more credibility. So they brought along Christopher Steele and all of his memos. This article finishes here saying, the whole mess began when the DNC sold the phony idea that Putin stole its emails. Now that happened around the summer of 2016. You remember that, the DNC emails were hacked. And then right away, the Democrats came out and said, well, it's Russia that did it. And oh, by the way, Donald Trump's working with Russia. And you remember the statement, the joke on the campaign trail. You know, maybe Vladimir Putin ought to go after those emails of Hillary Clinton's. But this says here, to this day, the FBI has never tested the computers. Jim Comey's FBI didn't test them. The FBI to this day hasn't tested them. It says instead the FBI put its head in the sand and allowed the DNC to construct a Russia did it excuse to deflect attention from its damaging emails. It's never really been properly investigated. What exactly happened to the DNC emails? In 2016, they just came right out and said, well, it was Russia. And that helped get the narrative going. That, well, Donald Trump is working with Russia, of course. But listen to this. It says Comey ridiculously allowed the DNC to hire CrowdStrike to conduct the crucial autopsy in this murder investigation. Dmitry Apelropovich, co-founder and chief technology officer of CrowdStrike, is a Russian expat and a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, a think tank with a non-Trumpian agenda. So basically this outfit that was hired to go and give the autopsy on all these DNC servers. It was this outfit, CrowdStrike, headed up by this Russian expat. Well, we're one investigation into it, and we'll see what comes from the others that follow. Over the weekend, there were more than a few commentators predicting that at some point there would be indictments. We'll see. This is Arizona Congressman Andy Biggs on Fox News Sunday, clip four.
And I anticipate that we're going to see some very stark revelations of manipulation of the whole system for political purposes. And when you see that happen, that's when I think you're going to see references or referrals for indictments. And I think you're going to actually see some indictments. I hope you do, because this is trying to take down a sitting president is absolutely outrageous. It's essentially a coup attempt. And that's what we saw happening here.
That's what we've seen. And just the details, the revelations from last week, it only adds more damning details to the story. Kevin Brock had a piece at The Hill. The worst is still to come for Jim Comey. That's from the other day. And then Andy McCarthy, he focused in on what we talked on the program on Friday. That meeting again, January the 6th, and just how prepared Jim Comey was for that interrogation. It was an evidence-gathering opportunity. This was not Jim Comey and the FBI trying to help President-elect Trump. They were trying to take him down. As Andy McCarthy says at National Review, Donald Trump was always the target. The point of the Russian investigation was to make a case against Donald Trump. Preferably, the case would drive him from office. And so what did we learn? What did we learn from that investigation that was released last Thursday? It says, what we learn is that Comey and his top FBI advisors prepared extensively for the then-director's January 6, 2017 briefing of then-President-elect Trump. It says, the detailed preparation owed to the fact that the FBI regarded the session at Trump Tower in New York as not a mere briefing, but as an evidence-gathering opportunity. That's because they were investigating Trump, which they hoped to continue doing when he took office. So he says that the situation called for them to put the president at ease, which is why Jim Comey went in there then and said, well, you're not under investigation. Don't worry. You have nothing to worry about here. And oh, by the way, here's all of this salacious content that's been out there circulating. And the media, they're about to run with this. But then as we learned from the report last week, you had the secured laptop waiting in the car for Jim Comey as soon as he left Trump Tower so that he could start typing this official memo. Andy McCarthy says here, this was not a briefing. It is criminal investigations 101. Get the suspect talking so a comfort level is established, then zing him with something that will rock his world. Thus confronted, a suspect will often blurt out either an implicit admission of guilt or a false exculpatory statement. Either one is a home run for the investigator. Either way, they get a false statement or they get an implicit admission of guilt. It says, and make no mistake, Comey was the investigator. The zing was elaborately planned, and so was the postmortem. A bureau car equipped with a secure computer would be at the ready. While Trump's words were still ringing in Comey's ears, the then director would begin typing out the then president-elect's reaction to the ambush, his responsive statements, his reasoning if he had tried to justify himself, his demeanor. Andy McCarthy says the investigator wants to get all of that in his report. That way, the suspect is locked in. As a practical matter, once you have given a version of events, making up a new story when you are later charged and informed about the prosecution's evidence is not an option. Innocent people do not have multiple versions of events. They have one story, the truth. Only guilty people lie. That's why, for the investigator, a false exculpatory statement is as good as a true confession. That's why the ambush works so well. Now, what McCarthy then goes on and talks about is the testimony that Jim Comey gave in front of Congress later when they asked him about these memos. And he used the words recollection recorded. And McCarthy explains how that if it's just simply something where it's he said that he said this, you know, the he said she said thing, that those things aren't accepted in court because they're hearsay. But there are rare occasions when if it's an official memo like from the FBI, this is the recollection I recorded right at the scene, right as it happened, then those in certain cases will be admissible in court. So this is the way he was thinking, Comey, and all of his fellows. They were thinking we've got to get Trump to say something incriminating, and then we'll put it on the memo. We've got the laptop, the secure laptop, waiting in the car. And there's going to be a series of these memos. And, well, we went through some of that detail on Friday. The four that were not classified but confidential, and then the others that were classified. But here's Jim Comey. He's got his own storage devices at his house, just similar to what Hillary Clinton did. He's operating as an institution of and by himself. And the FBI didn't even know about his memos. They didn't even know about this paper trail. All of that comes out later. But it was planned. It was certainly planned ahead of time. Andy McCarthy says, thanks to the IG report, we now know more of the gory details, but as I've tried to show in Ball of Collusion, that's his new book, the underlying truth has been discernible for a long time. The Obama administration launched an investigation in which the target was Donald Trump and the objective was short-circuiting his presidency. It would certainly seem, if in a fair world anyway, it would certainly seem like there are going to be some punishments handed down. But we will see. We're going to be talking more on this and even writing about this at thetrumpet.com. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Throughout the Bible, God refers to human beings as his own children. Many people, however, say God just doesn't seem real to them. God is a great mystery. Yet, their human fathers don't seem like a mystery. Why does God seem unreal? In Mystery of the Ages, Herbert W. Armstrong answers that question. In this book, Mr. Armstrong strives to make God as real to you as your own human father. Do you realize that God, as described in the Holy Bible, is actually a family? That he calls human beings his children because he wants to be their father? This magnificent truth, once understood, will help you understand your Bible like never before. Mystery of the Ages will guide you in your study of God's Word and will make plain this incredible, seemingly unbelievable truth. We would like to offer you this book, Mystery of the Ages, absolutely free, no cost or obligation. In many ways, Mystery of the Ages is about Herbert Armstrong's close personal relationship with God the Father. It contains a powerful message that God revealed to Mr. Armstrong during their constant contact, their continual conversation that lasted for nearly six decades. If you thoroughly study Mystery of the Ages along with your Bible, you will get to know God. Request your free copy of Mystery of the Ages today. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com.
The Trumpet Daily.
So there were quite a few commentators over the weekend drawing attention to that World War II anniversary we talked about on Friday's program, Sunday being the 80th anniversary of the start of World War II. So it was nice to see some commentary on that subject. This is from Harry Kazianis. He wrote a piece at Fox News asking if World War II, or not if, but World War II started exactly 80 years ago. Is World War III on the way? Good question. Is World War III on the way? The deadliest conflict in human history began exactly 80 years ago when Nazi Germany invaded Poland. Britain and France came to Poland's defense, and suddenly, World War II was underway. Estimates of civilian and military deaths in the war go as high as 85 million. He asked, could there be a World War III? Could there be a World War III? Could it happen? Leaders know if they ever turn to nuclear weapons, the nightmarish death toll would make World War II look like a minor skirmish. Think about my father's article from 2014, I think it was, The Unthinkable Will Happen. Mr. Armstrong, Herbert Armstrong, had a classic sermon along those same lines. But the point that my father has made is that the last world war ended with nuclear weapons. What are we even trying to wrap our minds around if the next one begins with that? We've got to be emotionally prepared for what's coming. It says here, no one can predict the future or say that World War III would be impossible. Well, God actually does tell us about the future. Jesus Christ actually said, it is coming. Great tribulation, such as was not since the beginning of time. The world's never, ever, ever seen anything like it. But what's interesting is he goes on and talks. Now, he doesn't understand Bible prophecy, but he talks about some flashpoints around the world. Flashpoints to watch for. Cyberspace, he says. World War III could very well begin in a domain that never existed during World War II. It says no treaties or international bodies police the conduct of nations on the internet. So cyberspace has become like a 21st century Wild West frontier town with no rules to keep the gunslingers from battling it out for supremacy. That's from that Fox News article. And you read through this first flashpoint, as he calls it, and immediately think of Ezekiel 7 and verse 14. My father's talked about a massive cyber attack. So when the trumpet of alarm goes off, as that prophecy says, no one goes to battle. The prophet Ezekiel says they have blown the trumpet even to make all ready, but none goes to battle. And so somehow or another, there's a total breakdown in communication. That's brought on by, as my father's written before, a massive cyber attack. He says further, this is another flashpoint, I'll just focus on these two. A U.S.-China trade war becomes a shooting war. Now, again, this is not that far off base. It's not that we're going to go to war against China first. It's going to be against the European superpower, as we know. Well, really, it's not even correct to say we're going to go to war against them. It's going to be brought upon us. A complete surprise attack, just like I said with the previous flashpoint. The trumpet of alarm is sounded, but none goes to battle. But we have said that trade war leads to shooting wars. His article says, imagine if the world's two largest economies, worth around $32 trillion combined, start shooting at each other. Think that's impossible? History tells us it's entirely possible, and the spark could be today's current trade war. Well, I thought that was interesting as well when you, again, consider the Mart of Nations prophecy in Isaiah 23. The United States and Britain being frozen out. And then again, we're in a vulnerable position. A massive cyber attack. And then the surprise attack coming from the German-led European superpower. On Friday's show, we went back and looked at some of that history. Leading up to World War II, Winston Churchill, of course, referring to that war as the unnecessary war. It could have been stopped. It could have been stopped anywhere along the way. If the West would have just stood up to the forces of tyranny. Winston Churchill, remember, after the Munich surrender and the jubilation in Britain. I mentioned this at the end of the program Friday, but he said, look, you can't blame our brave people, but they should know the truth. They should know about what's been going on the past 5 or 6 years. The German buildup of armaments and what we've been doing to ourselves. Following Munich, Churchill said, I'll begin. He got up and said this in Parliament, and it nearly ruined him for good. He was already in the wilderness. He was a backbencher. He gets up amid all of the jubilation, all of the celebrating, and he says, I'll begin by saying what everybody would like to ignore or forget, but which must nevertheless be stated, namely, that we have sustained a total and unmitigated defeat. We have sustained an unmitigated defeat. Total defeat, he said. Defeat without a war. That took some courage to deliver a message like that. He said, don't suppose this is the end. This is only the beginning of the reckoning. This is only the first sip, the first foretaste of a bitter cup, which will be proffered to us year by year, unless by a supreme recovery of moral health and martial vigor, we arise again and take our stand for freedom, as in the olden time. We need to raise the ruins of that empire's greatness. Otherwise, we're doomed. Courage. It took courage to deliver that message when everyone else was cheering for Neville Chamberlain. My father says in the Winston Churchill booklet that the biggest challenge each one of us must always face, do we really want to hear the truth? Do we have the courage to accept the truth? As a leader, do we have the courage to tell the truth? Notice Isaiah 30. On Friday, I read through those verses in 2 Timothy, where Paul said that in the last days they would want smooth things. They want to hear smooth things and deceits. People don't want to hear the truth. But this is why we have to turn to our Bibles. for truth. If it doesn't square with God's word, then there's no truth in them. Look at Isaiah 8 and verse 20. There's all kinds of New Testament verses I could refer you to as well. But you know, what's interesting here too is that my father makes this point in the Churchill booklet, that if you wanted the truth in the 1930s, you could get it. Well, that speech I just quoted from, October 5th, 1938, Churchill gets up, he says, look, I'll start by saying what everyone else would like to ignore or forget. We have sustained a total and unmitigated defeat. Now, that was the truth. And a lot of people didn't like it. It takes courage to accept a message like that. But the point that my father makes in the booklet is that you could have gotten to the truth if you wanted it, if you had the courage to accept it. And the same is true today, isn't it? You look at this world, you look at all of the flashpoints, to use the language in that Fox News story. Look at all of the flashpoints. Look at what's universally ignored. The focus, the level of interest that we put into the mass shootings. And those are tragedies on a scale that it really is hard to fathom. But still, the tens of thousands who are killing each other every year or killing themselves, that's just become routine and nobody writes about it. Nobody cares about what's happening on the streets of Chicago or Baltimore. And then, of course, the nonstop coverage of other tragedies or storms. And not that those don't deserve some coverage, but look at what's being missed. That's the point. Look at what's not discussed. Isaiah 30 and verse 1, it says, woe to the rebellious children, says the Eternal, that take counsel, but not of me, and that cover with a covering, but not of my spirit, that they may add sin to sin. Woe unto these rebellious children who seek counsel, but not from God. No, we look to men. We devise schemes that actually deceive people. When we tell them what they want to hear, this is what they want. Give them what they want. They deserve it. Well, the prophecy continues. Verse 8, now go write it before them in a table and note it in a book, that it may be for the time to come forever and ever. You see, God does tell us about the future. He gives us a lot of detail about what's coming. He predicts the future, and he's right. He has a 100% track record. It says here, verse 9, write it in a book. Make sure you record it because it's for the future. And then it says in verse 9 that this is a rebellious people, lying children, children that will not hear the law of the Eternal, which say to the seers, see not, and to the prophets, prophesy not unto us right things, speak unto us smooth things, prophesy deceits. Just like Paul said in 2 Timothy 4, I read that Friday. Here it says people want to be deceived. They really don't want the truth, most of them. And so they're duped, they're deceived. Churchill said back in 1932, this was 1932, the year before Hitler came to power, he said, I cannot recall at any time when the gap between the kind of words which statesmen used and what was actually happening in many countries was so great as it is now. He was just stunned by the fake news. It says, the habit of saying smooth things and uttering pious platitudes and sentiments to gain applause without retention, or rather without relation to the underlying facts, is more pronounced than it has ever been in my experience. Well, that was in 1932, and listen, it was going to get a lot worse. In 1938, Chamberlain came back with that piece of paper and waved it before the crowds in Britain. And the whole nation rejoiced. My father, he gave a program. This is from December of 2009, just talking about the mindset for most in the lead up to the start of World War II. This is clip one.
Leading up to World War II, even in 1939, the very year that the war began on September the 1st that year, and the media and the government in Britain were talking about a golden age was about to dawn on the world. And it was just about it was the worst nightmare they'd ever experienced that was about to come upon them. So actually the media and the government and the people that were supposed to be warning them and telling them about what was coming were all wrong. They were all wrong about what was going to happen.
The media, the government, they all got it wrong. They were all talking about a golden age. A golden age. Just before Hitler's army marched on the Sudetenland in Czechoslovakia, the Times of London, the Times was essentially the voice of the British government at the time. The Times of London blamed Czechoslovakia for the dispute. The Times of London said that it was Czechoslovakia that was being obstinate. Not Germany, not Hitler, not the Nazis. In fact, when Germany marched on Czechoslovakia, there were a lot of reports in the West that said, well, I think the Czech people, they actually prefer German occupation. They like Hitler. They were saying some of the same things when they went into Austria. Truth failed in the 1930s. Truth was cast to the ground in the 1930s. William Manchester, writing about Fleet Street in his book on Churchill, said that Fleet Street, that's the street where all the newspaper publishers were situated, he said Fleet Street withheld news of the moves and countermoves in London, Warsaw, and Berlin because they knew their countrymen would disapprove. They knew their countrymen, well, they just wanted to hear one message. And so the newspapers were happy to oblige. They want smooth things. We got to give them smooth things. And meanwhile, over at the BBC, you had the program director there that was basically putting a gag on anyone that would criticize Hitler, including Churchill. Verse 11, it says, this is Isaiah 30, get you out of the way, turn aside out of the path, cause the Holy One of Israel to cease from before us. My father says in the Churchill booklet, he says, Isaiah 30 and verse 11 ought to shock any person who believes the Bible. Here's a group of people among whom the Holy One of Israel dwelled. And now they want God to stop leading them. They don't want to be led by God. They want to trust in man. Verse 12 says, wherefore, thus says the Holy One of Israel, because you despise this word, and trust in oppression and perverseness, and stay thereon, therefore this iniquity shall be to you as a breach, ready to fall, swelling out on a high wall, whose breaking comes suddenly at an instant. The punishment, God says, it comes suddenly. But still, if you had your eyes open to the truth, as I said earlier, if you want to know the truth, you can know it. But for those who have their heads firmly buried in the sand, you see, the breaking, it comes suddenly, at an instant. Are you awake to what's happening in the world today? Over in Isaiah 56, the same book here, the prophet compares Britain's and America's leaders in this end time to lazy, slothful watchdogs. They're blind to what's happening. Isaiah 56:10, it says, his watchmen are blind. They're all ignorant. They are all dumb dogs. They can't bark. They're sleeping, lying down, loving to slumber. Here we have all of these ferocious threats surrounding us, ready to devour us. And look at what our leaders, our commentators, our voices in media, look at what they're saying or not saying. Verse 11 in the Revised Standard, it says, the shepherds also have no understanding. They have all turned to their own way, each to his own gain. One and all, come, they say, let us get wine, let us fill ourselves with strong drink. And tomorrow will be like this day, great beyond measure. Those are the leading voices. They're more concerned about selfish interest than they are about the peace and the safety of our nations. These are watchmen who were set on the tower. God gave them that position. But they're failing in that mission. And we're heading into the worst time of suffering on this planet. Satan's the god of this world. He's confined to this earth. Well, we'll continue. Hopefully, if we have some time tomorrow, we can continue our study going through the well-known verses in Ezekiel chapter 33. But I need to cut this just a little bit short so I can hurry across campus for the forum with the college students and the academy students at the top of the hour. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to submit feedback, you can email us, td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.